week of September 1st, 2013, this is Showbiz Sandbox episode 203, the podcast that brings you all the dirt on the news-making headlines around the entertainment world. In Los Angeles, I'm Jay Sperling Reich.
And at the Billie Jean Tennis Center in Queens, I'm Michael Gilts.
Literally, you are at the Billie Jean Tennis Center in Queens because you are headed to the U.S. Open of Tennis. And congratulations, I did not know that you were that good at tennis.
Well, I was a qualifier and I made it through and I'm very excited and I'm happy to be in the fourth round.
The fourth round of drinks or?
That's more like it. Yes, I am a big tennis fan and I'm at the U.S. Open all this week and last week, all throughout Labor Day weekend into the week. So I'm going to have a lot of fun. And I'm going to chain myself to the Louis Armstrong, which is the best venue to watch tennis at the stadium, at the arena, at the event. So, of course, they're going to tear it down.
Oh, yes. Well, nothing.
Because they want more skyboxes. They want more money. They're going to ruin the venue for everybody.
Well, nothing says tennis like Louis Armstrong, the famed jazz trumpeter.
Well, he was a tennis fan and he lived in Queens, New York. So there you go.
Well, you know, and we're always looking for money too, which is why we request that you subscribe to our show on iTunes, iTunes or Stitcher, or again, the Zune Marketplace or the Microsoft Marketplace, anywhere they give podcasts out for free, please do subscribe to our show, rate and review it, even though it doesn't cost anything and we make no money from it. So I don't know how we're money grubbers. I don't know. You can also follow us on Twitter at Showbiz Sandbox is our username. And we're on the Facebook, not just Facebook. Showbiz Sandbox is our username there, or you can email us. dirt@showbizsandbox.com is our email address. That's dirt@showbizsandbox.com. Or call and leave us a voicemail, 888-567-SAND. That's 888-567-7263. That's all of our contact information and ways to follow us and ways that we, I don't know why I said that we were, you know, trying to make money off of this. That's for sure. Especially since
What you're not doing. Yeah.
Yeah. I mean, we're working on Labor Day for Pete's sake.
But what will people be hearing about on this week's show?
Well, actually, on today's show, we'll tell you how Paramount Pictures is trying to make some money. They're trying to take advantage of Trekkies with the release of the latest Star Trek film on home video. We'll explain how. Last week, you may have heard a thing or two or maybe 10 million about Miley Cyrus and her racy performance at the VMAs. Laugh at her, though you might. Cyrus is laughing all the way to the bank since it seems her onstage gyrations are helping the sales of her new single. Of course, during Big Deal or Big Whoop, we'll cover all the big entertainment headlines. We'll end by telling you how one music publisher may have picked a copyright fight with the wrong legal scholar. But first, as always, we turn it over to entertainment journalist extraordinaire Michael Gilts, who's going to fill us in on the weekend's box office.
All right, now we are talking about the number one movie around the world, and we're covering the three-day weekend, though in North America it's a holiday, so there's more movie going today. So it's really a four-day weekend in America, but these figures mostly cover the world and just the 3 days of Friday, Saturday, Sunday. With all that said, the number one movie around the world for this three-day weekend is One Direction, This Is Us, the concert film about the boy band. It grossed $31.5 million worldwide. It cost $10 million to make. I don't know how much they spent to advertise it, but this is a winner right out the box.
Well, I mean, I know that you always love to talk about how concert films don't make money. Look, you know, U2's.
No. I'm just saying you got to put it in context. When people say, oh, this Jonas Brothers concert film only made $17 million, I say, excuse me, that's one of the 10 highest grossing concert films of all time.
And that's where I was headed with my comments. I was going to say how you always like to say that concert films don't make money, or at least they're not high, you know, big box
grossers.
Office.
Yeah,
yes.
Exactly.
And this is it. So having said that, this is a huge hit.
Oh my God, it's a monster. It's already in the top five grossing films of all time in concert movies in North America.
And
I
should have looked this up before we started, but do you know how it compared to this whole Justin Bieber film that was released a couple years ago?
Well, Justin Bieber is the highest grossing concert film in North America of all time. Michael Jackson has the worldwide title.
Oh.
Justin Bieber has it in North America. So it's they tend to make all the money first weekend and then die. Miley Cyrus was the one exception where she had a couple week run, and we'll see where it ends up, but it's already in the top five. So, you know, this is a big, big grossing movie. When they made the Katy Perry movie and it only made $7 million on its opening weekend, they said, oh, what a disaster. Well, no, that's in the top 10 or top 15 of all time right away, full grosses. I'm not talking about opening weekend. I'm saying almost no concert films have grossed more than $1 million. Only about 16 films in history have grossed more than $1 million at the North American box office. So concert films are not big draws. So in context, Katy Perry making $7 million on her opening weekend is terrific. If you spent $30 million to make her movie, you're a fool.
That's true.
Since That's the point. But One Direction, they made it for a dime. They made it for $10 million. They knew it would be a big hit in the UK, which is where it made most of its money overseas. It's made $31 million worldwide. It'll probably be off the charts in 3 weeks, but by then it will have made $40 or $50 million worldwide. Then you've got DVD sales, so this is a winner.
So let me ask you this. I know that for a while, One Direction, this concert film was the number one movie here in North America.
For a while, but this weekend.
This weekend. Friday through Sunday. But now, counting Monday, which is a holiday here in the U.S., Labor Day, it looks as if The Butler is going to win out.
That's right. The number one movie in North America, if you're looking at the four-day weekend, it is The Butler.
Which
made $20 million compared to the $18 million that One Direction has made over the 4 days. That's the estimate that we have right now. One Direction, front-loaded, made a lot of its money on Friday. That's how these things work. Lee Daniels, The Butler, is getting very good legs. You know, it's showing it's moving on its way towards 100 million North America.
Well, so it had President Obama saying, "I saw The Butler and it made me cry." And I'm thinking, could you get better press than that? You got the President of the United States talking about how he saw your movie and it was so good it made him cry.
Well, that's certainly nice, but he's not known as a person that sells movie tickets.
No.
You know, Oprah being in the film matters more than Obama saying he liked it.
Fine.
But so that's the deal in North America. It's a 4 day weekend. The Butler triumphed over the 4 days. It's their first Hollywood film. It's the first film of any kind this year to repeat at the North American box office for 3 weeks in a row. That tells you how quick the turnover's been. So it's been a record grossing summer, a big jump in ticket sales, 6% jump in ticket sales, a record grossing Labor Day weekend. And at the top of the charts in North America is Lee Daniels, The Butler. At number two around the world is Elysium, the Matt Damon sci-fi flick. He made another $24 million. It's at $176 million and counting. At number three is the Jennifer Aniston, I'm a Stripper movie, We're the Millers. Another $23 million. It's at $150 million worldwide. At number four, quite a disappointment, Percy Jackson, Sea of Monsters. Another $15 million. That's $137 million and counting, but it costs $90 million to make. No one's going to lose their shirt. But this is not a success, and it's probably the last Percy Jackson film we'll see for a long time. At number five around the world, Planes. Disney's made a big point. This is not a Pixar film. It's not a Pixar film. Well, they proved it thanks to the reviews and the box office, because it's made $15 million worldwide. It's at $100 million in counting, which is a far cry from what most Pixar films make. At number six around the world, as we said, is Lee Daniels, The Butler. We were looking at Rent Track numbers, and they sort of messed up. It should be
over 100, close to $100 million, and it's 75 here. So you're right.
Well, no, it's at $74 million North America for the three-day weekend. And then it made another, I guess, $4 million on Monday, or $6 million on Monday. Is that what it made?
I guess, yeah.
Yeah, so this movie should have been higher up. It made about $20 million worldwide. It's all in North America, and it's at $80 million in counting. I beg your pardon. So Lee Daniels, The Butler, made $20 million basically in North America. It's at $80 million and counting.
Would have put it in about fourth place,
right above Percy Jackson, Sea of Monsters.
Right, worldwide. Yeah, of that money, by the way, coming from the U.S. and Canada.
Right, North America, as I said repeatedly.
Oh,
yeah,
okay.
It has not been released overseas. Who knows if they ever will? At number seven is Mortal Instruments, City of Bones, the first of a would-be franchise. It made another $14 million. It's at $43 million in counting. In North America specifically, it dropped from 3 to 7. It fell pretty hard, 45%. It didn't make a lot of money to open. It's not making a lot of money now. It only cost $60 million to make, but with only $43 million in the till, it's going to have to make a lot more overseas just to sort of break even. So another would-be franchise that may have fallen flat. We will, however, be seeing The Conjuring 2, because The Conjuring made $13 million, and it's $245 million worldwide.
You think we're going to see The Conjuring 2? You see, I think we're going to see The Conjuring 9. I think we're going to see like 9 of these films by now.
That's possible. That's possible. At number 9 is Monsters University. It's at $715 million worldwide.
So speaking of Pixar films,
yes, exactly.
$715 million versus the This Is Not a Pixar Movie, $102 million. Yeah, I'd say you're right.
At number 10, the Adam Sandler film, Grown Ups 2. It just passed the $200 million mark, thanks to $11 million. A lot of that, most of that, almost every penny of it, made overseas. So Adam Sandler is a draw. It made about $70 million overseas, right? Is that right?
I think so,
yeah,
yes.
Yeah, about $70 million bucks so far overseas. So that's not up to the snuff of $130 million he made in the U.S., but still, that's a good amount of money. Number 11, Smurfs 2, that's at $255 million. At number 12, Now You See Me, that's at $308 million worldwide. Despicable Me 2, over $800 million. And then The Stolen Years. I haven't looked this up. I don't even know what it is. It's called The Stolen Years. It made $8 million. Since it's being distributed by Fuji, I'm assuming it's a Japanese film, but I have no idea.
I think it's about some years that were there originally, but then they went missing and they were assumed stolen.
That's right. I put all my effort into looking into the number 15 film, which is called Instructions Not Included. This opened in North America. It made $7.5 million over the three-day weekend. I don't know how it did on Monday, but this is the big story in North America. This movie opened at number 5 in the U.S. It's a Lionsgate film. Is it Lionsgate? No. LGF is somebody else. Or is that Lionsgate?
No, that's Lionsgate.
Okay.
LGF, Lionsgate Films.
Right. It opened on 347 screens, which is what Sperling would call a smidgen of screens, I guess. That's not a lot of screens. It made $21,000 per screen average. It's a Spanish language film. It's a huge success story for the actor, writer, and director. And his name is, I wrote it right down. Where is he? Where are you? Oh, Eugenio Derbez. He's a very famous star in Mexico. I've never heard of him before, though he did appear in Adam Sandler's horrific movie, that Jack and Jill. He had a small role in that movie playing a man and a woman. But anyway, he's a big star in Mexico, a string of hit TV shows. He's been appearing in a string of films. This movie is a gentle comedy. It's about a man who raises a little girl who's left on his doorstep. But 6 years later, the birth mother shows up. And of course, now he loves her and he wants to take care of her and he wants to keep her. And the birth mother wants the child back. That's what the movie's about. But opening on 350 screens, a Spanish language film, it's proving the draw of the Latino market and that you want to reach out to Hispanic and Latino audiences, people who speak Spanish, Spanish actors, Latino, Spanish, and Hispanic. I don't know how to refer to them. It's the people who speak Spanish or these languages around the world.
Yeah. Now just going
Latino
back to
and Hispanic is not. There's no word that encompasses both Latino and Hispanic. That's the trouble. You have to sort of reference both every time or you're leaving somebody out and they get offended as well. They should be.
What about Hispino or Hispanic?
Yeah, let's not do a J-Lo or let's not do a Brad and Angelina, Brangelina mashup for them.
Okay.
They can come up with one on their own.
All right.
But anyway, it's a big audience. It's growing in North America. Their economic power is obvious now. A lot of people recognize that. This guy, Eugenio Derbez, has a history behind him. He's the son of Silvia Derbez, a huge Mexican film and TV star. She made big hit films from the 40s on. She was a child star. I think she was like 15 when she made her first hit film. And she's been in a string of hit telenovelas all her life, including Simplemente Maria, which in 1989 was one of the biggest hits of all time in that genre. So he's the son of royalty. He's a big star. A lot of people know him. And the success of this movie proves both his rising power at the box office and the rising importance of this market, which means Americans, people who buy tickets. You want to make money? Make movies that appeal to these different audiences. Make a movie like The Butler. Make a movie like Instructions Not Included. Make a movie like those that can appeal to them. And if you're really lucky, broaden out to a wider audience and bring everybody else into the fold as well.
You know who really learned about the power of the Latino and or Hispanic market?
Who's that? Mitt Romney.
Yes, he did. He learned firsthand just how powerful they can be. Now, you were talking
about them to leave the country is not a good way to win their vote.
Yes, exactly. Now, you were talking about The Stolen Years. It is actually a Chinese film, and it's Fujian Hengyi Film Distribution. That's what the FUJ stands for on the rent track charts there. It is a romantic comedy, a comedy drama about a couple second time around, and the Film Business Asia outlet, which is a kind of a trade publication, it said it is poorly written and directed, yet it did pretty well, I guess, in China.
That's right. Well, one of the movies that did well this summer is Star Trek Into Darkness. It was one of the rare films that was both pretty well received commercially, critically, and did solid business at the box office, the highest grossing Star Trek film of all time, even adjusting for inflation. I felt it was a bit of a disappointment compared to Star Trek, the reboot, which I thought was one of the best films of the year, but it made a lot of money. There will be a third and fourth film. It came out on DVD and Blu-ray, or rather it is on the 3rd or the 10th. Is it the 10th that it comes out on DVD and Blu-ray? And it's sort of a controversial release. Why?
Well, here's the thing, and I guess it was not really talked about in the press, or at least in the press notes, But there are these retailer
press notes.
You know, basically, it's not as if Paramount Pictures went out saying, guess what, guys, we're going to have all these retailer exclusives, what are referred to as retailer exclusives. These are different versions of the film being encoded and packaged with, you know, different sets of all these special features. So the director's commentary and extra scenes and deleted scenes and which I guess would be extra scenes or longer scenes. And so if you buy it at, say, in the U.S. Target, you'll have one set of extra features on the Blu-ray. And if you buy it at Costco or Best Buy, you'll have a different set of extra features. So if you want all...
And if you buy it in Germany and buy it in Australia, yes, and you buy it elsewhere, if you buy it on iTunes, on and on and on. I hate this. Used to be they made as many extras as they could and they jammed them onto the disc and everyone was happy. Then somebody like Walmart said, hey, we want an exclusive extra, so people feel an extra reason to buy it at our place. I hated that, and I never would cover those extras or talk about them because I felt it was just annoying. In fact, what I hate even more is when they say you can only buy it at Walmart or Target for a certain amount of time. Then I wouldn't even cover it. I just won't talk about something if it's an exclusive to one outlet. It drives me nuts. Now, this is crazy. Star Trek Into Darkness, one of the main extras that people look for is an audio commentary.
Especially from J.J. Abrams, who does good audio commentaries.
Right, and this is a big feature that people really like. You watch the movie, he and the actors talk about the film, how they made it, how they did the effects, they tell stories. People really like the audio commentary. If there's one big extra I think that people care about, that's the one. Guess what? I have the Blu-ray combo pack. It's not on there. And you can't get it in Germany or else. You got to buy it on iTunes or use a code to download it. So I guess in my combo pack, there's a digital code so I can download the audio commentary track somehow. But that means I got to watch it on my laptop. Yeah. So I have this Blu-ray combo. I have a $2,000 television screen and an audio system, and I have to sit there and watch the audio commentary track on my laptop rather than on my PlayStation via my TV in that way. That's really annoying. You know, and I have Apple TV. I just bought it a few weeks ago, and the streaming does not work well. I've done everything I can, but you've got something online and you want to stream it to watch it on your TV, it's very choppy.
I bet you that's because you have Time Warner Cable internet.
I bet it is too, but not that I use a lot of, believe me, I shouldn't hit a digital cap because I do not watch a lot of stuff and I don't download much, you know, so I can't imagine I would hit a cap because that would be crazy. That means everybody in America is hitting a cap. But anyway, yeah, it's poor internet streaming service and all that stuff. But the fact is I have Apple TV. I can't stream it easily to my television. It's very choppy. It freezes up again and again. So there's no easy way for me to listen to the audio commentary track. And it's frustrating.
I agree. I don't like this. I mean, really, they know. And by they, I mean Paramount Pictures Home Video knows. Star Trek is one of those titles where you have a devoted core fan base that will try and get everything related to a movie. So if you're going to put an extra on one DVD and or Blu-ray at Target and then another on one at Costco or and Best Buy or Amazon, then they're going to go out and collect all of them, okay? That said...
But they're not going to be happy about it.
Right. It's going to cost them $102, over $102, about $103 to get most of the special features for Star Trek Into Darkness.
I think that's a very low estimate because I think if you look at the stuff in Germany and Australia... Now you're really, you got to get it from overseas.
Just talking about
you got to import it. You know, yeah, I think that estimate somebody gave was very low.
Well, I think it's just North American copies. And I would agree with you. I'm not disagreeing with you. I'm saying I think this particular estimate took into account only regional copies. So
do we care that some fan who wants the 2-minute extra scene with Benedict Cumberbatch taking a shower? Because that's one of the scene extras. He's taking a shower. And J.J. Abrams made a joke about it on The Tonight Show. And it's not available on the combo pack that I got. Not that I'm looking for Benedict Cumberbatch to take a shower, but he made enough noise about it that he talked about it on The Tonight Show, showed a clip of it, and said, oh, that'll be on the DVD, the Blu-ray, and it's not. So that's just annoying. Do we care that some fan really wants that extra 2-minute scene or that extra 2-minute featurette about Tribbles? Well, no, I guess not, but they're just screwing over their fans. They already make all these movies available on digital download a week or two or three in advance of the physical release. They are trying to push you not to buy the DVD and the Blu-ray. They want you to buy a digital download because it's cheaper for them to sell it to you. And it has fewer extras, by the way. But anyway, they're already pushing you to that. They're punishing you for buying it on Blu-ray, which is the best way to watch a movie. And now they're punishing you by withholding all these extras that they used to include and make a really valuable, nice property. Now they're just saying, nah, to heck with you. We don't care about you.
I mean, the reality is they've been complaining for, and the studios have been complaining for years about how physical media is going away. It's all the profits have dried up. And we used to be able to make a profit on a movie, even if it, you know, broke even or lost money in the theaters. And theatrically, we could always sell the DVD and or Blu-ray, and we'd break even or make money. That's where it would really make money. Now they're just pissing people off who buy the DVDs and Blu-ray, which is a really bad business model, in my opinion.
Right. If you want to squeeze out as much profit as you can from a dying format, you don't want to kill it off too soon. And that's what they're doing.
Right. Well,
there you go. There's another dying format. It's called the music video. People still make them, apparently, but I haven't watched one in years.
Really? We talked about Blurred Lines a couple weeks ago, and I was just shocked. I mean, I know who Robin Thicke is.
Blurred Lines!
Hey, you know what? Copyright, okay? That's fair use, by the way. Fair use. And if you want to know what we're talking about, wait until the end of the show. You'll know. That said, you mentioned this Blurred Lines. I was shocked I hadn't heard of it. I've been fairly busy this summer and traveling quite a bit. And so I went online to watch the music video on YouTube, as many people would do, to figure out what all the fuss was about. Well, I saw the music video, and apparently I saw the music video that was, came with some age restrictions, if you know what I'm saying.
All right.
And have you seen this video?
No.
It's basically a whole bunch of naked women dancing around. Literally naked, and I don't mean that in a figurative sense. They're naked.
Sorry, I'm distracted now. I'm sort of Googling something online. What did you say? All right, anyway. So it's a naughty video, but it's not the one that was shown on MTV. But that's not the point. We're talking about the Video Music Awards. People can still get attention. Obviously, a lot of people find new music by when they hear about a song, they go to YouTube, and they search for the song, and they play it. They might not even watch the video, but if they're naked women, they might. But they're not there to watch. They want to hear the song. And so video music and videos still matter, and MTV still has the Video Music Awards, and they got a big jump this year in the ratings. They've been sort of sliding for quite a while, but they got a big jump in key demos, with a good show that included a big 25-minute tribute to Justin Timberlake, along with a reunion of NSYNC and other big stars, including Robin Thicke and Miley Cyrus duetting on Blurred Lines, which is one of the biggest hits of all time. It's been on number one for 11 weeks in a row, and it might just well, repeat and be number one for 12 weeks. We'll know as soon as Billboard releases their chart after the Labor Day weekend. But it's a big hit, and they had a big performance on the VMA. I bet families gathered around to watch this lovable moment.
They did, and then they spent the next day at their maxillofacial surgeon to try and reattach their jaws.
Okay, now, yes, Miley Cyrus got a lot of grief for her sort of trampy, I'm a stripper performance.
That's
which
right.
Is all like, why talented singers and performers and actresses feel or allow themselves to be portrayed as strippers and whores, which is what I feel like they do when they're on these covers of these magazines and they dress literally like a whore or a stripper, half naked or naked. I don't get it. I don't know why you'd allow yourself to do it. I understand why you want to be mature and grow up and get away from your squeaky clean image of the Disney's channel, but I don't understand why you want to behave like a stripper. My favorite response was somebody said, oh, Miley Cyrus was making fun of and satirizing the whole stripper persona. That was my favorite spin on it. I imagine she's probably embraced that by now. But I watched it. It was just embarrassing, but it didn't matter. The video got 15 million views. CNN had it as their number one story the next day, Onion actually effectively spoofed and said, CNN does not care about you. All they care about is your eyeballs. They don't care about news. They just care that you're on their website watching a stupid video.
But don't you think, this was all choreographed. I mean, Miley Cyrus
and her team. It wasn't a mistake.
No, of course not. I do think that there was a point during the performance where even the technical director over at the Video Music Awards ceremony went, okay, we probably should cut away from her because she's doing some really weird things with that foam number one finger that she has. And so they stopped showing her, which I thought was kind of interesting. No,
that's not true. I don't think so. Did you get somebody who said that they cut away from her when they weren't supposed to?
No, this is just
She was in the first part of the song. And then it went over to Robin Thicke and his other dancers. That was not, she wasn't singing anymore. That's why they weren't showing her.
Okay. Well, that was
It was a duet. I didn't think it was a very good duet. It's a great song. It's an incredibly catchy song. Don't look at the videos. Just listen to the song. It's a very, very fun summer song. And frankly, the performance on the VMAs, I thought, ruined it. It was not a catchy, good performance.
I couldn't agree more.
But it was successful.
Well, I guess I could agree more, but I agree with you. And I guess, here's a question. What is the deal between Robin Thicke and Marvin Gaye? They're all suing each other, the estate of Marvin Gaye.
We covered that already.
We did? What did we say about it? Remind me what we said about it.
They threatened to sue, claiming that his song was a ripoff of a Marvin Gaye song, and the Parliament Funkadelic people claimed it was a ripoff of their song. So the Robin Thicke people are suing both of them in advance to get to let the courts establish what the truth is.
Okay.
So they're all suing each other. There's certainly a very similar vibe to a song off Marvin Gaye's Let's Get It On album and the Robin Thicke song. No question about it. You play them back to back, you can hear it. It's got a party vibe. You know, it's, you know, that Marvin Gaye song.
Oh, yes.
It's got a very similar vibe. No question, but it doesn't feel like a plagiaristic issue. So they're all going to settle it in court. But they went on the VMAs. They got a ton of ratings. They got a ton of video hits. The song's number one for 11 weeks. Everybody's happy. And then, of course, people said, oh, look at Miley Cyrus. She's benefiting from this. Her song, We Can't Stop, has bulleted up the charts. Well, it was already at number three, so it can't bullet up that much more, can it?
I guess not. Well, two spots.
No, it was at number three last week, before the VMAs.
Right, but it could bullet up to number one, two spots.
Ah, well, yes, but ahead of it is Robin Thicke's Blurred Lines and Roar by Katy Perry, which she also performed at the VMAs. So all three of them are jostling each other. The New York Times somehow looked in the crystal ball and said Robin Thicke's song will repeat at number one. I don't know where they got that info from because Billboard hasn't released the chart yet, but maybe they know something we don't.
Well, now let me ask you something. There's this big charity concert in Central Park in New York, which are any of these folks performing at that show?
Well, it's just four people are performing. It's called the Global Citizen Festival. It's, I think, the second one. It's an event to try to raise awareness of worldwide poverty and encourage people to be active citizens. You don't buy a ticket to this concert. What you do is you do charitable works and gain points, and then you get a free ticket to the event. It's taking place in Central Park on the Great Lawn. I think it's September 28th. Stevie Wonder, John Mayer, whose new album is very good, Alicia Keys, and the Kings of Leon will all be performing. So, you know, that's the event. It's to encourage charity. It's to encourage people being volunteers and doing good deeds. And it's to raise awareness about global poverty and global education and the rights of women. I don't know how well run it is. I don't know anything about the Global Citizen
Initiative. Well, let me ask you this.
But it's certainly a worthy endeavor.
Let me ask you this. Are we talking about this because there's a big controversy over the secondary good deed market?
No.
Where that's the only way you can get tickets is go to a good deed broker.
I think we mentioned this last year about how you do some good deeds and get points and get a ticket. So I think we covered it last year.
We did, yes.
But it's sort of an interesting phenomenon. I don't know, again, how much of their money goes to infrastructure and how much is actually to actual things that do good around the world. So I can't speak to the charity itself, but it's certainly an attention-raising thing that seems good. But what's interesting is that it's a big event in Central Park. It's the first one in a long time because Mayor Bloomberg's a schmuck. Thank good he's leaving. And they haven't had
Wait,
big
now, is that a political... Is that like the Democrats, the Republicans, and the schmucks? Is there...
Yeah, that's basically what he is. He's been both a Democrat and a Republican, technically.
Okay.
But he's sort of stopped concerts in Central Park that were open to everybody. He would let corporations buy it out and hold private events. But basically, you wanted to have a big show, maybe Billy Joel, Elton John doing a show for New Yorkers to celebrate life. No, can't have that. So this event is taking place in Central Park. It's on the Great Lawn. Not everybody can show up because you got to have a ticket. So that's a bummer. But it's for a good cause. And Major League Baseball, of all people, is going to be streaming the show online.
Because they're going to be performing nine innings first?
Tell us what's going on. It's the Major League Baseball Advanced Media Group. It's their digital media division. What's going on, Sperling?
Yeah, so, I mean, MLB Advanced Media is the part of, or it's a separate corporation, a separate organization owned by the 30 Major League Baseball teams together.
And it's used to stream baseball games online.
That's right.
You go online, you can buy a package, and you can watch your team or other team live on the internet. And except for the way they charge you and the stuff that they do, it's a very good service as far as how well it's run. It's very smooth. It's very efficient. It's blue chip. And everybody recognizes they've got a great back room and a great network set up to do this sort of streaming service because there's a lot of people watching this stuff online.
That's right. I mean, for years, they were doing it audio only in the late 90s, early 2000s, and it was great. And then they said, okay, well, broadband is here, so we'll start streaming out-of-market games onto... I loved it. Then it got a little too pricey, and I stopped using it. But as far as, and you say blue chip, it is. As far as sports leagues go, this is the MLB Advanced Media is the group that everybody, the NBA, the National Football League, FIFA, this is what they're all trying to copy because they do such a good job. So good, in fact, that, you know, Glenn Beck uses them as his back room for his
stuff. They said, look, we've got this ability. We've got this network. We've got all this technical backroom structure built up. Let's rent it out. When we've got more than we need to do the baseball, we can now use this talent we've achieved and market it and sell it to other people. So Glenn Beck hired them to do his online streaming. ESPN3 uses them for some streaming. Even Southwest Airlines, the airline company, uses them for one of their in-flight services. So they've made a good business. They built it for themselves and they said, hey, we're doing this so well. It's kind of like Amazon. They built their back room and now they market it to a lot of other people. And that's where they make a good chunk of money. And so now baseball is doing the same thing with the structure they built for streaming video online.
Right, precisely. And in this case, it looks like they're going to quote-unquote, co-produced this Global Citizen Festival, and thus they have licensed the rights to stream it online. And this is the first time they've licensed and purchased the worldwide rights, whether it's, you know, whatever, for TV, radio, as well as digital. We'll see if they continue to try and get into the licensing content business. As you know, Michael, that's not an easy business to be in, whether you're in sports or otherwise. It's a very difficult business to be in. So,
but I think they're more about being the back room. They said, hey, let's team up with this charity, team up with this event, show off what we can do, that we can do more than just sports. And now maybe when somebody else has a concert and they want to stream it and they're looking for somebody to handle the back room, they'll turn to Major League Baseball Advanced Media.
Yeah, look, they say they're going to license other products or other other content, like I said, in other events. We'll see if they do that. It wouldn't be the first time where a company that was associated with a very specific product, in this case, Major League Baseball, went off into kind of other markets and became more known for those other markets. Motorola, for instance, you know, forget where they are today, but originally in the early 1900s was a car radio manufacturer. Thus, their name Motorola was the, you know, was a AM radio manufacturer, and they became more widely known for walkie talkies and telephones and, you know, mobile phones. Be that as it may, it started off in a completely different market. Can the same be said of Major League Advanced Media in the future? Well, I don't know. We'll see.
All right, so John Mayer's going to be performing at this concert. He'll probably play the song Wildfire. And if you haven't heard it, you might be at the show and go, hey, what's the name of that song? And if you're like me, you might hold up your smartphone and put on your app Shazam. And that will tell you what the name is of the song that you're listening to.
Actually, it would not tell you that. And here's why. And why? I'm not trying to contradict you. That is normally the way you do it. SoundHound or Major League Major League Baseball. I mean, SoundHound or Shazam, what they use to figure out what a song is, and SoundHound is better at this. If you like sing into it, it can tell you what the song is. So SoundHound would be better for this. Shazam, which I'm having trouble pronouncing, is actually using an audio thumbprint and of what is being played.
So a live version would not work?
Correct.
Ah, well, there you go. So there's a flaw in Shazam. However, they've figured it out pretty well that when people want to know what a song is on the radio or on satellite radio that they're listening to in a restaurant or something, if it is a recording, they can hold up their song and find out what the name of that tune is.
That's right. And if you're in SoundHound, what does that mean? You know, if you're SoundHound, you can like whistle into it and it will sometimes tell you if you're like on key.
if you're lucky.
So it'll tell you what the song is, but then what people are actually doing is saying, yeah, that is a really good John Mayer song. I'm going to buy it to the tune of $300 million, which we've kind of reported in the past. And now what they're finding out, they being the industry, is that that's accounting for about 15% of global digital music sales between SoundHound and Shazam and all these music ID apps.
So that's a great way. It makes sense. You hear a song, whether in concert or on the radio or maybe on TV, you're watching at the MTV Video Music Awards. You say, oh, wow, that's a really catchy song. They're probably announcing it five times at the Video Music Awards. But, you know, I mean, actually, Justin Timberlake did a medley of like eight songs. Maybe you don't know what the middle one is. You can hold it up, find out the name of the song. And you see, if you like it enough to find out what it is, you probably want to buy it.
That's true.
So it's just that instant gratification. You find out the name of the song, you're in the car, don't do it while you're driving, but you're in the car, you hear blurred lines, you don't know what it is, you never heard it before because you're spurling, you use your app, you find out what the name of the song is, and you press buy because they make it as easy as possible for you to do that. And that's why, one reason, why Blurred Lines has been number one for 11 weeks in a row. It's one of 27 songs in history to be at number one for more than 10 weeks or more.
Yeah, I mean, when we talked about Blurred Lines and then I realized how long it had been number one, it was like at that point, it was like 6 or 7 weeks. I thought, how did I miss this? And I just kind of chalk it up to busy summer. What can I say? And I don't listen to a lot of pop music on the radio. That's another thing. Thank you, Spotify, by the way. And so I don't hear these kind of like poppy Blurred Lines type songs anymore. I have to.
Right. So there's 27 songs that have been this kind of a monster hit. I mean, 10 weeks at number one is a huge amount of time to be on top of the Hot 100, the Billboard chart. Before 1991, when they switched to SoundScan and actual sales for a lot of this stuff, it only happened twice. You Light Up My Life from 1977, and God Help Her, I just saw Debbie Boone peddling something, some like wrinkle-free treatment on television, playing her song, You Light Up My Life.
Well, here's my question. Does it work?
And Olivia Newton-John's Physical in 1981. So that was it in the entire history of rock and roll, according to this article. There were only two songs that ever went 10 weeks or more. Elvis didn't do it. The Beatles didn't do it. No one did it. And there's just two of them. One in the 80s, one in, one in the 70s.
Yeah.
And then now we've had 25 in the last like three decades. So suddenly we've jumped to like 8 a year.
Yeah.
That's the average for each decade. I mean, 8 a decade. So almost one a year, we get one of these monster hits like Rihanna's We Found Love or Mariah Carey, Boys to Men's One Sweet Day, Barry and Monica's The Boy Is Mine, Puff Daddy and Faith Evans' I'll Be Missing You, and on and on and on. So why is it that there are all these R&B songs? It's because those have been the big dominant genre of the past 25 years.
That's right. And basically, R&B and hip hop, they kind of were rising to the fore, in the 90s and 2000s. And that's when SoundScan started to change the way the Billboard Hot 100 was created.
And bringing it back to Robin Thicke, he was a success on the R&B charts for a number of years. And I think he valued that acceptance by that audience because he's white. He really valued it, just like George Michael and other white artists have, to be accepted by that community, to be played on the radio, on the R&B charts, and have that success meant more to them than crossing over or being a hit on the white audience charts, or the overall charts, if you want to call it. So it's very sweet for him to be now have this massive career-defining hit, which is, the big hit of the summer, one of the big hits of the year and all time. But he began and had his first big success on the R&B charts where all those other acts started. And I think that base and that level meant a lot more to him than just this one big crossover hit.
Yeah, I would imagine that for Robin Thicke, the success of that song has been quite the big deal.
Ah, okay, moving on.
Yes, indeed. It is time for Big Deal or Big Whoop, our weekly segment where we discuss the top headlines in entertainment and tell you whether they're really important or just overhyped nonsense. Our first story, well, we'll know more when the judge's ruling is actually released. And the case, which was heard in Florida, is sure to be appealed. So know that even whatever the judge says, it's going to be appealed. But it's possible that a new precedent could be set with the summary judgment in a lawsuit between the MPAA, the Motion Picture Association of America, and a digital storage locker company called Hotfile. The Hollywood Trade Group says Hotfile's entire business is based on illegal infringement of copyright, and that it even paid people to upload illegal content like movies and TV shows. Hotfile says it's a storage locker and has no responsibility for what its customers store on their service, and studios like Warner Brothers abuse their privileges in deluging it with takedown notices on material for which they had no right to do so. A judge has ruled that Hotfile is indeed liable for copyright infringement, the first instance of a cyber locker being held accountable for such actions. What the exact ruling is will be determined soon, along with the likely appeal. But is this a big deal or a big whoop, Michael?
I think it's a big whoop.
What?
Because I think it will be overturned. I do not think this will stand. I the company's a little unusual because they did encourage people to upload content. And the more you upload it as an early subscriber, they gave you like a discount or they gave you points or money or something like
On the space. So they'd say, you have 2 megabytes, but if you upload certain things and other people like it, you get more space.
Right. So the studio say, you were encouraging them to upload Star Trek Into Darkness and all the extra features that you're missing, which I'm not encouraging. But there you go. That's what they say. But I say it doesn't matter what they did. Your telephone company's not responsible for what I say and do on the phone. The Apple is not responsible for what I write on their computer, and I don't think Hotfile is responsible for what the people uploaded to their lockers.
Well, I guess it'll boil down to, was Hotfile actually enticing, copyright infringement? That's really what it's going to boil down to. We'll see.
It sounds like a dangerous precedent. If it is, if there's an appeal, I think it will be narrowed down to something like that, as opposed to you are responsible for what people do in their digital lockers.
Right, because it'll just kill Safe Harbor.
They'll become responsible for what they did to entice people to illegal action, but they will not be responsible for what you do in your locker, because that seems untenable to me.
Well, yeah, again, it would kill Safe Harbor, which we will be talking quite a bit about during the next 10 minutes. But first, here's an interesting story from The Hollywood Reporter, at least interesting for the end of August when very little happens. Actress Octavia Spencer won the Oscar for her performance in The Help, skyrocketing her career and, of course, the possibility of endorsements and commercials. After careful consideration, according to her people and her representatives, Spencer signed with a company called Sensa. She claims she turned down a $3 million offer from another weight loss company because Sensa agreed to her conditions. And these are what her conditions were. She didn't want to tout significant weight loss, but just a healthier lifestyle. She didn't want before and after photos in the ads she appeared in. She didn't want the ads to run in tabloid magazines or gossip sites. They've gone back and forth on all these details once the campaign launched. Now, the reason Sensa claimed she breached her contract, that Octavia Spencer breached her contract, were the actress's tweets. To conform with new regulations, every tweet she sent out touting Sensa and Sensa products included the hashtag SPON, SPON.
So as in sponsor.
Yeah, hashtag SPON. So and that was so that people would know she was a paid sponsor for that product. But that means people don't pay as much attention to what you have to say. And at least that's what Sensa says. Now everyone is suing everybody else, as is their want. Big deal or big whoop, Michael?
I think it's a big whoop. It doesn't matter in the scheme of things. But it's kind of fascinating, first of all, that somebody would pay her $1 or $3 million just because she won the Oscar. I don't want to be insensitive, but you win the Best Supporting Actress Oscar, you're not suddenly a famous person.
No,
you know, I don't think it follows that suddenly you're going to be a person that people are going to want. But hey, they realize she has a pull. She's maybe she reaches the black market. Maybe they have trouble reaching that market. Obviously, she's a much more popular figure there. Maybe that was their reasoning. But the idea that she was getting $3 million to do this and $1 million to do that, I'm like, really? Wow. People can barely remember that movie, much less what her name is.
Yeah,
I mean, I'm not trying to make fun of her. I'm just saying as a commercial business decision. You say, who won the Oscar last year for Best Support? Or like, what was the name of the actress who won the Oscar for her performance in The Help? Very few people would have trouble knowing. And if they saw a picture of her, very few people would be able to name who she is. She's a talented actress, don't get me wrong. God bless her. But I as a business decision, that's a little bizarre to me. That's just people being dumb and jumping on a bad wagon. Oh, she won an Oscar. Let's give her $2 million. But that's okay. They made the deal. But this, was it the FTC, Federal Trade Commission? Was that
yes.
the one who put out this
yes.
new ruling? Yeah. They said, look, if you're sponsored by a company and you're putting out tweets and stuff, you need to let people know that that's a paid advertisement, that you're not just saying that out of the goodness of your heart.
That's right.
And so now smart celebrities are saying sponsored or paid ad or doing something on their tweets when they're doing something related to a product that they are paid to promote, as well they should. So one of her tweets said, bet you've seen my new Sensa weight loss commercials and wondered if it's the real deal. I'm here to say it works. But then at the end of her tweet, she put hashtag spawn. And they're like, don't do that. People see that. And they don't pay attention. Don't do that.
Whereas I would have seen that and said, oh, I wonder what the hashtag SPON is. And I would have gone to Google and typed the acronym SPON.
All right. Well, there you go. And of course, she had all these things in her deal, which I can appreciate. She didn't want to have ads in like the National Enquirer or on sleazy gossip sites, you know, and she had all these conditions. But then once the campaign began, they went to her and said, you know, we really want to run this ad. And she said, okay. She agreed to let some ads run in tabloids. She agreed to some before and after photos. So she had all these conditions and she caved on a lot of them and let them do some of this stuff. But then they still were not unhappy because it wasn't moving the dial on the product and they wanted to get out of the money they owed her. That's the basic, that seems to be what it boils down to. And her people make a pretty good claim. And if she did turn down a $3 million offer, that's fascinating. I assume she has, or they wouldn't say so in public. So that'll be a fun thing to find out in court. You know, she turned down $3 million from someone
else. This will all be settled.
Yeah, it'll be settled before.
I think we've already talked about it longer than we probably should have.
I'm sure you're right. But it's interesting about the hashtag and trying to identify, hey, if you're sponsoring a product, you know, you're paid advertiser, you got to let people know. I find that interesting.
Well, American Idol is barely in the top 10 anymore and might drop out of that ranking next season. So news about the show shouldn't be that important. So why are we talking about it? You know, but, you know, as a sinking ship is always more fun to cover than one that's, say, cruising along. And Idol has definitely sprung a leak. I think we've talked about this a couple times. It had a firm deal to feature hot producer Dr. Luke as a new judge alongside J-Lo and Keith Urban. Or rather, it was firm until it collapsed. The official reason? He had too much on his plate. That's the official reason. But now it's clear Sony pushed back because it didn't like the idea of a producer linked to his label, linked to the Sony label, feeding talent to a rival. In this case, the rival being Universal Music, which, of course, has first dibs on Idol contestants. Dr. Luke begged Sony to let him do it, and even offered to hand over half of his $12 million fee to Sony. And Sony said, let me think about that. No. Idol is furious at CAA, and that's the Creative Artists Agency, which assured them his contract wouldn't be a problem at all. Fox is angry that Idol is asking Harry Connick Jr. to step in because they're lukewarm on him, and production of the audition rounds was endangered while they sorted through the whole mess. Connick Jr. signed on finally as the third judge, and almost nobody is happy. Big deal or big whoop, Michael?
I guess it's a big whoop. I mean, Dr. Luke's career is not going to fade away anytime too soon. Idol is certainly in trouble. Now they've poisoned their relationship with Harry Connick Jr. by making clear publicly they didn't want him to be one of the judges, even though he seemed like a likely choice. But I'm really fascinated by Dr. Luke. He told the studio he'd give him $6 million to let him be on the show. And they said no. They were already pissed because they let him produce a Katy Perry album, and that proved a huge hit for another label. And they're like, why do we keep loaning this guy out? Not that they own him, but they're like, why do we let him? We got this deal with him. Why are we letting him do all this stuff for other labels and make them a lot of money? And they just saw this as one more step. I think it's stupid. I think it's like, you know, set him up on the show. He becomes more famous, more popular. That brings more attention to what he does. Presumably some of his acts from his label would be able to go, you know, and be on Idol. Surely they'd have some crossovers, some artists he produced.
Wait, I'm confused. You're saying that an entertainment company, in this case a record label, might be short-sighted? Kind of like, I don't know, releasing DVDs and Blu-rays with different features depending on where you buy it?
That's right. And for those who don't know, Dr. Luke was a lead guitarist on Saturday Night Live for many years. And then he really broke into the big time when he co-produced Kelly Clarkson's, you know, Titanic song, Since You've Been Gone, which was a massive, massive hit. And since then, he did I Kissed a Girl for Katy Perry and Who Knew for Pink and just lots of big hit songs. So he's a major, major producer right now. And he clearly, he's a major producer, but people at home don't know his name. And he wanted to become a celebrity.
Yeah.
And, you know, a celebrity beyond the music world. And I think that would have raised his value for Sony. So I think it was a dumb decision.
I couldn't agree more. Well, I keep saying that. I could agree more. I agree with you in any case. Right before the preseason of football begins, I think it begins next week, right?
Don't ask me. College football began, I know that.
Okay, well, the NFL found Jesus and decided they wanted to help all those players suffering medical traumas due to brain injuries derived from playing a very brutal game. They've offered a $765 million settlement to some 4,500 ex-players, so they'll each get minus the legal fees. Actually, the players owe the league money. Anyway, as I was mentioning, with lawyers' fees, you know, we can all get back to watching football just in time to ignore the Frontline documentary about how the NFL hid this scandal and ignored medical information for years. Big deal or big whoop, Michael?
I think the preseason already began. So
yes, preseason did.
It's right before the season of football began.
Okay,
I think because they just announced this. So it's a big whoop. I think this is an unbelievably small amount of money. It sounds like a lot, $765 million. But when you're talking about thousands of people and their medical bills, $170,000 per person, that's known as like 2 weeks.
Right.
In the
hospital. I was going to say, I would consider it a big deal because it doesn't really cover much.
It covers nothing. I don't know why the players settled. I mean,
I don't know either.
What's that going to cover? I mean, that should be in addition to covering their medical fees, you know? So I think the NFL got away with a slap on the wrist, as far as I'm concerned, because the chances are they knew for decades about this and they wanted to hide it and not deal with it and look the other way and ignored the evidence. And we're looking forward to seeing that Frontline show to see how culpable they are.
Well, Netflix keeps pushing into new areas. I'm trying to find one of these stories that's a big deal for you, Michael.
Okay, it's a slow week. It's August.
Yeah, well, along with comedies like Arrested Development and dramas like House of Cards and Orange is the New Black, Netflix is now offering concert films, which we all know do so well. Well, stand-up Aziz Ansari is bringing his newest show right to Netflix, straight to Netflix, with the company committed to promoting it with a serious marketing campaign. They also have stand-up specials in the works with Mark Maron and Kathleen Madigan. Big deal or big whoop, Michael?
It's a big whoop. You know, he's not a big name. You know, he's on Parks and Recreation. He's got 3 million Twitter followers. He's not a breakout person in stand up yet, like Louis C.K. was. But, you know, it shows them moving into new areas. It makes sense. If it was like the biggest name in stand up that they landed, that would be it. But they've got, you know, solid deals with some solid stars on stand up like Mark Maron and Kathleen Madigan and Aziz. So, you know, it's reasonable and smart, and it's not a surprise.
A couple points here. One, I thought it was very interesting in all the articles about this that Ansari was saying, you know, people kept coming up to me and saying, hey, I saw your comedy special on Netflix. It was great. So we decided, you know what? I'm just going to take it straight to Netflix.
But who says that? Who says I saw it on Netflix? I wouldn't even remember if I saw it on Netflix or Hulu or on demand or on HBO. I have trouble remembering what day of the week it is. I certainly don't remember what content provider I watched an event on. I'm lucky if I remember the event.
Well, that said, I think this story is interesting if only because it really is just another link in the chain of how Netflix is competing directly with HBO. HBO, of course, has long been a leader in airing comedy specials, and now Netflix is saying, we're not only going to provide original content, same kind of original content you would provide HBO, but we're also going to provide these specials, these concert specials, much like you would.
There you go.
Well, now, director Ken Loach, who we talked about just a couple of episodes ago, he's not the only major figure in cinema to announce his retirement. Now, Japanese legend Hayao Miyazaki, probably the most revered feature animation pioneer since Walt Disney, he's announced his current film, The Wind Rises, will be his last. The announcement was made at the Venice Film Festival with a news conference to take place this week in Tokyo for the 72-year-old filmmaker who has a studio and son carrying on his legacy. Among Miyazaki's many acclaimed films are My Neighbor Totoro and Oscar-winning Spirited Away. Big deal or big what, Michael?
Big deal. Yay!
Oh, my goodness, finally.
he's a legend. It's a sad ending. You know, it's not sad. He's 72. He decides to take it easy. He wants to retire. I haven't seen The Wind Rises. I hope it's been getting good reviews. It hasn't come to the U.S. yet. It certainly will. Disney has been releasing them properly for many years. So, you know, I hope he's ending on top, and it's a sad but, you know, triumphant ending to a great career.
Well, you know, we don't normally cover casting news around here, but the film version of the wildly popular and somewhat naughty erotica novel, 50 Shades of Grey, maybe you've heard of it, Michael.
I have. Spanky, spanky.
Yes. I don't know what that means. It found a star. The young college student slash journalist will be played by Dakota Johnson, the daughter of actors Don Johnson and Melanie Griffith, and star of the TV series Ben and Kate, which lasted for, you know, I think one season, frankly.
Can you imagine her mom there? Her parents are probably the one people who'd say, oh, honey, you're going to be playing an erotica porn starry type character. Wonderful. We're so proud of you.
Yes. Well, the 27-year-old billionaire with a penchant for S&M will...
SM. Come on.
Fine. Will be played by Charlie Hunnam of Sons of Anarchy.
Hunnam. Not Hunnam, is it?
I don't know. Hunnam. Of Sons of Anarchy and Pacific Rim. In real life, he's 33 years old and Johnson is 23. Is this a big deal or a big whoop, Michael?
It's a big whoop for them. I don't know if I would have taken it, Charlie. He's a very good actor. He hasn't made a lot of great movies yet, but I like him a lot. So, you know, hopefully this role won't push him into Mickey Rourke territory, but will make, you know, be a success and give him a better chance to make more good movies. But Dakota Johnson is certainly a big break for her. Whether it'll be actually good or just ridiculous nonsense, we'll have to wait and see.
Well, you know, that is what this section's all about.
There will be, of course, a DVD with more explicit scenes available that you won't see in the theater.
But you can only buy it at Target.
Or you've got to go to Japan to buy it.
That's true. Where Hayao Miyazaki will be, you know, putting the DVD together.
Yeah, you know, reading up on Hayao, he really wanted to make a movie about Pippi Longstocking. And they were obsessed with Pippi Longstocking. And they went to Sweden and they met with Astrid Lindgren and they talked to her about it. And they had a deal to do it. But then after they met with her, she took the rights away and said, no, thank you. I don't know what they said to her, but she decided they just weren't the ones for her. So that's very sad. So all these years, he wanted to make a Pippi Longstocking film. But when she met him, she said, uh-uh. Anyway, I thought that was kind of interesting.
Well, okay. In any case. Moving along to singer Linda Ronstadt. She hasn't performed in public in a while, and now we kind of know why. 8 months ago, she was diagnosed with Parkinson's disease, a condition that makes it very difficult to sing and impossible for those who would sing on a professional level, certainly. The multiple Grammy winner has a memoir called Simple Dreams coming out September 17th. Normally, that would be tied into a new album or career retrospective by any smart label, frankly. But Ronstadt says she never expects to be able to sing again. Big deal or big whoop, Michael?
It's a big deal. I'm very sad. I love Linda Ronstadt. I've never seen her in concert. I've never interviewed her, but I think she's a terrific talent. And she's been so talented in so many areas. That's why I think she's so underappreciated, because she's a woman. And I'm not usually into gender politics, but I think she's been treated as sort of a gadfly. Oh, here she's singing jazz. Here she's singing mariachi music. Here she's singing, you know, children's music and Gilbert and Sullivan. She's just flitting about and you don't take her seriously. Whereas a male artist who does that, like Paul Simon, is acclaimed for playing in a lot of different genres and areas. I mean, she has been nominated or won Grammys in more categories, I think, than any other performer in history. I think there are producers and writers who've also been in a lot of categories, but she's been there in pop, rock, country, folk, Mexican-American, tropical Latin, children, and that doesn't even include her work for, the jazz music, which was put into the pop category, where she was doing, you know, big band music, singing classic standards with Nelson Riddle producing, you know, and arranging that stuff, which she was getting really good at until Nelson Riddle died. She did three albums. Each one was better than the last. She was really coming into her own. Then he died. So that's a shame. But then she did Gilbert and Sullivan in live theater and in the movies. I mean, she's just a terrific talent. But what's weird here is Parkinson's disease. In fact, I've read about some people who use singing as a tool to deal with Parkinson's, because it does mess with your throat and makes it really hard to sing. But some people sort of fight against that and exercise the throat, have like having group sing-alongs together, and they found singing to help them.
It depends on the type of Parkinson's, but
right. But it's kind of funny. You heard it as therapy for people who have Parkinson's, but of course, these are not people who are singing professionally. If you're going to actually sing for the public and record, then it's a nightmare, because it's an illness that will not, you know, that will really mess with your ability to sing. So it's very, very sad. She says, quote, "No one can sing with Parkinson's disease, no matter how hard you try." So that's very sad. And, it's a long career with a lot of great distinguished stuff in it. So there's no reason to think like we've had lost opportunities, but it's a shame to have her have to go out this way.
Well, now here's a seemingly minor story that is the tip of the iceberg when it comes to data caps. Remember I said we were going to be talking about data caps?
I did.
Well, data caps are the limits your internet provider puts on your service. Once you go over that certain limit, suddenly they slow down your service until it becomes, well, just dreadful, frankly. It's not just an annoyance. Without net neutrality, that is, without the internet providers treating all traffic the same, just as telephone companies treat all calls the same, the amount of mischief they can get into, these internet service providers, is alarming. Internet providers might charge big companies a fee to download their websites quickly. So, you know, like Netflix, they'd charge extra to. The result? New websites won't be competing on a level playing field. That's what would happen here. One of the big areas of contention is streaming of TV channels. Time Warner Cable just announced it would stream hundreds of cable channels, I think 300 cable channels, through an Xbox app, and wouldn't include that in any of their subscribers' monthly data caps. The result there? They would be feeding people into their own service and away from, say, I don't know off the top of my head, maybe Netflix or Hulu or any other company offering a similar service. Comcast launched a similar app on Xbox with similar controversy. Big deal or big whoop, Michael?
I think it's a big deal, but I'm going to defer to you.
I would say it's an incredibly big deal, because this is exactly what you're trying to avoid with net neutrality. You're trying to avoid people who own the content and the means of distribution. Say, I don't know, Comcast, you might say, well, NBC shows don't count against your data cap because we own NBC.
Right. But people will be hard to keep all that straight. But when it's something as simple as, oh, use this app and it won't chew up your data cap, then you'll do it. Now, what happened to Comcast? They proposed this. Did they do it? Did people fight them? Are they still doing it now?
They've done it. Time Warner Cable has a similar app and is saying that none of the data going through this pipeline or to this app will count against your data cap. So here's the thing. The way they're doing this is saying, this isn't the internet. We're not going to the public internet. This is going from our head end, our facilities here at Time Warner Cable, and going directly to one of our customers inside the network. So it's never hitting the public internet. So therefore, net neutrality does not apply. They're using a loophole to get around net neutrality.
But there's no law against for or against net neutrality anyway, is there?
No, it's kind of.
I mean, you can do what you want.
They're supposed to be net neutrality and it's supposed to be semi-regulated.
But they're already like dialing down my service if I hit a cap, which is not net neutrality, right? Data caps are against net neutrality, aren't they?
No. Data cap is a service-oriented issue.
Yes, but it's malarkey.
They're basically saying you can get a certain amount of data.
Right.
That's one thing. What they can't do is say, Netflix, your data will get to Michael much faster if you pay us extra. That's net neutrality.
Right, because their service already sucks, so saying it'll come faster means they'll just give you decent service for extra money. And, of course, it's data capping is another way of net neutrality because they're saying you have to use our service and our app or we'll chew up your data cap and then you'll have crappy service.
Right, so that... Right.
It sounds like they're saying, oh, look, well, you don't have to worry about it. Just use this app. But in fact, what they're doing is punishing other people like Netflix and Hulu and anybody else that's not them and making their service less desirable.
Correct. And that's really, we'll see what happens here. I mean, the reality is they are using a loophole in current regulation
to get around. But Comcast already did it. Nothing's happened to them, right?
No, but they
nothing's going to happen to Time Warner until a law is passed. And who's going to do that?
Well, I guess we would have to be Congress, right? I mean, well, notice how all of these apps come out in the middle of April. Sorry, the middle of August. When like all of Congress is on vacation.
Uh-huh.
So, yeah, there's a reason why certain announcements are made in August.
So it sounds like it's a little inside baseball. It's the insidery thing about data caps and net neutral and all this, but it really does affect the actual service you get in your home. We have the worst service in the industrialized world when it comes to internet access, right?
Yes, correct. It's some
terrible
of the worst
service.
Yes.
My phone slows up, even though I am not a heavy user at all on my phone, and even my phone will slow up towards the end of the month. It's ridiculous.
Well, you know, since you mentioned Inside Baseball, why don't we move on to that segment of our show, Inside Baseball? And that's where we analyze some of the headlines that have the entertainment industry buzzing. We'll explain what they mean for the business, and more importantly, how they affect you, our listeners. And this week, I guess this could affect our listeners. And
well, here, let me take the lead, because you're going to have to explain it.
Okay.
All right, it's about Harvard professor Lawrence Lessig, and he's in a copyright fight over fair use. He has a lecture that he gives in Harvard, and he posts stuff online, and he did a whole video on fair use and stuff and how songs can spread around the world. And he used the example of the song Listomania by the French pop group Phoenix. And this is one of those songs that sort of like Call Me Maybe spread around the globe. People all over the globe made their own versions of this song, just like they did. You know, you had troops in Iraq doing a version of Call Me Maybe and school children and nuns, just like that. That happened a few years ago with this song, Listomania. So he did a video about that, talking about how people can connect with each other around the world. And he would show brief clips from all these different versions of this song, Listomania, as well as the Phoenix Band's version and other stuff like that in giving his lecture. So as far as he's concerned, it was all fair use. But now he's being sued by their record label, an Australian record label, Liberation Music, because they said he didn't have the right to do it.
Yes. And this is, I mean, he's Lawrence Lessig is a very well-known internet activist. He helped found Creative Commons. He kind of does a lot of copyright work, and he believes that copyright laws should be loosened up a bit. He has spoken. He gave a very well-known and famous talk at the TED conference about, you know, living in a read-write culture, that we are a culture of mashups and how we're turning our youngsters, our younger generation into criminals.
Artists, great, or creative, oh, criminals, yeah.
Criminals, but, because they're basically using everybody else's, you know, they're in part using other people's work and mashing it up with their own to create new work, which is pretty much what we used to do all the time. He's written a number of books. He's also a professor at...
He's saying the kids are criminals because of stupid laws, not because of what they do. He's saying their creativity should be encouraged.
Correct.
But the laws need to change so that they're not turned into criminals.
Yes. He wrote Remix, Making Art and Commerce Thrive in the Hybrid Economy.
So if there's anybody that you would target for fair use, probably not a smart idea to target Lawrence Lessig because he knows what he talks about.
Yes. Michael, you and I have been a part of some of these takedown notices through YouTube.
That's right. Insane. We're at Cannes. We're doing a review of a movie. We use a clip of the trailer that the studio provides to us and says, hey.
Without audio, in fact. We didn't even use the audio.
We're just using a visual to promote their film and talk about it, which they encourage us to do, provided the video so everybody could do that. They're delighted we would do it. And then they sue to take it down because it's a clip from their film.
Well, but they're not suing. They just
They're just sending a takedown notice to YouTube saying, oh, hey, they're using our film. But it's the trailer that they wanted us to use.
I don't even think that they're doing that. actively. No. I think that there's all these algorithms.
It's a program. It's a program.
Right. And they say, hey, there is some video thumbprint that matches the video thumbprint of this copyrighted material. We have to take it down. And right. there's so many of those, you know, I don't want to say false, but erroneous takedown notices filed. Well, in this case, Liberation Music claimed that, hey, we own the license to that 2009 song, and you can't use it in your speech. And then even worse, you kind of videotaped it. I think it was taking place in Tokyo, and then you put a 49-minute presentation online on YouTube that contained this song that we have.
Did it contain the entire song, by the way? I didn't watch the video.
I'm sure it didn't, but I would. I can't say for sure.
Right. So what's going to happen? He's suing them. They're suing him. What's happening?
Well, what happened is, and this has kind of happened to us as well. We just didn't take it as far as Lawrence Lessig did, is that he, you know, a takedown notice was filed with YouTube. YouTube took it down and let Lawrence Lessig know. That's the way the DMCA works, the Digital Millennium Copyright Act. Now, it's then Mr. Lessig's turn to turn around and say, well, here's why my use of that copyrighted work is what's called fair use. I'm allowed to use that because I'm altering it in some way, or I'm it's commentary, or it's newsworthy. It's different than the original. And so he did that. Well, then there was some exchange between Liberation Music and Lawrence Lessig, in which I guess Liberation emailed Lessig back in July and said they would take immediate legal action against him if he tried to prevent the removal of his lecture from the web. And they would sue him if he didn't remove his or withdraw his counter to the takedown notice. Because what happens with a takedown notice is, once Liberation says, hey, take it down, it's copywritten, and once Lawrence Lessig counters that, unless Liberation Music, the copyright owner, can prove through court documents, basically say we've asked a court to step in here, YouTube has to lawfully put it back up. And so Liberation knows that it's going to have to file some form of legal action to pull
it. And now this is going to set a precedent.
Right. And basically,
but everybody would still have to fight it case by case.
Well, yes, but what's really going to happen here is what he's trying to do, what Lawrence Lessig is trying to do, and I applaud him for this, is he's trying to show, look, you cannot flaunt the DMCA. You cannot just file. And this is what Hotfile was trying to say, is you are just filing one takedown notice after another, because then it becomes onerous to file counters to all of them. Well, in this case, he's saying not only is it onerous and not only is this a problem, but you're actually trying to stifle my freedom of speech and you're trying to put a chilling effect on my work so that I won't use anything like this.
So if we're lucky, he'll stop people from doing abusive takedown notices and maybe establish some new fair use interpretations of the law that actually benefit consumers and the public.
Right. I mean, the problem is fair use is a very gray area. Are you really adding something to the copyrighted work? Are you really commenting on it? Have you created another work with that work in it? That's the problem. And he's trying to say,
well, it's a gray area, but we want them to give the benefit of the doubt to the people, not to a corporation that's stupidly just harassing people who aren't doing anything wrong.
Right. And what he's saying is that Liberation Music is in violation of Section 512F of the DMCA, and that they, quote, acted in bad faith when it sent the takedown notice, knowingly and materially misrepresenting that it had concluded that the video of his talk was an infringing use of the copyrighted material. Now, here's what I would say. I don't think that they did. I think that they just automatically sent that takedown notice.
But that's the problem. And that is knowing and materially misrepresenting that it had concluded. They didn't conclude it. They just sent out a thing. That's exactly what he's saying.
Right.
If they use a computer program like us, we use their trailer and they send us a takedown notice, that is knowingly and materially misrepresenting that they had concluded that our video was infringing, which it wasn't. So that's exactly the burden now, instead of on you and me, is on them. Before they send out 10 million takedown notices a day, they got to actually find out whether there's been a violation.
Right.
And that's where the burden should be.
And Google is saying the same thing, because they're getting, you know, they basically used to get like, you know, a thousand takedown notices a year. Now they're getting like millions. So they're just
easily.
You know what, guys? If you're going to flaunt this, we're actually going to, you know, we haven't been kind of pushing back and saying that you're misusing, because there are serious penalties for misusing the DMCA takedown notice process.
Not that they've ever been applied.
Right. And so now Google is saying, you know what? If you're going to keep doing this, we're going to start applying them, and we're going to start pushing back through a legal course of action.
And this case could be the perfect. And you know, sometimes you talk about a case going to court. You really want an ideal case to sort of. It doesn't get clearer than a Harvard professor giving a lecture and using, you know, brief clips of a video and other copycat videos online to tell the story to be an example of fair use.
Yeah, I mean, in short, he was saying, look, here's the Realistomania video and here's all these, you know, fan covers. So, and
which they have allowed online all over the world.
Right. And those are still up, the fan covers. Now, the Electronic Frontier Foundation, who we've had representatives from that organization here, they're teaming up with Lessig to file this lawsuit. It'll be very interesting to see how it progresses, and I look forward to seeing how it progresses. I wish him the best of luck in his fight there, because I think it's a noble one.
Well, I look forward to finishing off my Labor Day weekend and heading out to the courts for some more tennis.
Oh,
what
okay.
do we tell people before we say goodbye?
Well, we usually tell them that they can subscribe to our show on iTunes or on Stitcher or in the Zune Marketplace or the Microsoft Marketplace, the Google Play Store, wherever you can get podcasts for free, wherever they give them away for free, you can subscribe to our show. And we really do urge you to subscribe to it and to rate and review the show in those podcast aggregators. We truly appreciate it. Now, we also tell them that links to all of the stories we've discussed on today's episode can be found on our website, showbizsandbox.com. That's also where you're going to find ways to follow us, whether it be on Twitter, where our username is @showbizsandbox. You can follow us on, or like us, I suppose, on Facebook, where you can look us up under, guess what, Showbiz Sandbox. You can even email us. dirt@showbizsandbox.com is our email address. That's dirt@showbizsandbox.com. You can leave us a voicemail. The number to call is 888-567-SAND. That number, again, is 888-567-7263. Now, all of that information, as I just mentioned, can be found on our website, showbizsandbox.com. The music that you hear at the beginning and end of each show is by the popular indie rock group MGMT. They can be found on their own website, whoismgmt.com. They have a new album coming out. Now, Michael, you have a website, if I'm not mistaken. What is it?
You can find my work at teardownarthurashstadium.com.
Now, I have no idea what that means other than the fact that, I guess, Arthur Ashe Stadium is where the U.S. Open is held. But just in case you can find some of Michael's work there, you can find it at michaelgiltz.com. Or, of course, you are the head curator and owner of bookfilter.com. You run the ship over there. Some of my work can be found on celluloidjunkie.com. Until next week, play nice.